In 1967, we awoke to the knowledge of the village. Now, 50 years on, we invite you good citizens to join us in celebrating the timeless topics, eloquent prose and striking visuals of the iconic programme, The Prisoner.
Your attention please. All villagers are invited to take hold of their box sets of videos or discs to have their collections at hand as number 89 discusses with number 3 his choices for the quintessential tripartite of prisoner episodes.
Number 3. Now, I guess we'll call this divine symmetry. You and I are going to explore an opportunity and explore the idea with you as a diligent fan of The Prisoner to talk about that polemic. Which of these episodes do you love? Which of the episodes do you want to share? And which of the ones, one, might you want to throw away? So I want to walk you through these three steps. You have 17 DVDs, Blu-rays, video cassettes. What of those programs, and more importantly, why, what's the one that you would watch most often that is just your comfort episode, the one that speaks to you the most? What is it?
Probably, and I haven't had time to really think of the reason for this, but Many Happy Returns, the one that has almost no dialogue for most of the episode, and it's just number 6, realizing that he's alone in the village, mm-hmm. and he's got to just make a do-it-yourself escape, and, I won't spoil the ending for anybody who hasn't seen it. I just find that one absorbing. I find the music, the score for it, absorbing. Mm-hmm. And it's just a lot of fun. It's a change of pace, but it doesn't pull you out of things like that awful Girl Who Was Death episode. And it also sort of reminds me a little bit of some types of do-it-yourself YouTube videos and reality TV that is so prevalent now, because you get to go through the whole process with him from the time that he wakes up and realizes he's alone, to chopping down the tree and everything else that he's doing. Do you like that episode? I don't think I've ever really spoken about that with anybody before.
Well, that's interesting. So and you can talk about the ending because the audience, of course, knows all these endings. We actually, number 28 and I have talked about Many Happy Returns, where our focus on that was, when you take each episode, they're divided into 4 parts, fundamentally, you know, for commercials and that kind of thing. What we said was, we appreciate the first 2 parts, but really the story only kicks into the second half. And so much of it is packed into just the latter 20 minutes that it makes it a very intensified episode. Because, sure, there's the him getting out of the village, getting back to what he understands finally is London. But you're right, that nonverbal makes it very odd versus once he gets back. One of the things we pointed out was it seemed to be one of the more bigger stretches for Patrick McGoohan to be acting, because once he gets back to his house, he has to actually be nice to the character Miss Butterworth because he has nothing to give. He's not just that cranky, stern person, right? He's almost flirtatious with her to be able to get in her good graces. And even this other nuance where you mentioned when he has to, you know, gather resources and build the boat, there's this scene where he's just about ready to launch his raft and he hears the sound of a dish break. And you see in his face this absolute despair, as if he's going to turn around and see number 2 already catching him. But it just happens to be a cat, right? Which is, you know, the famous metaphor for women. I think what I said was, I agree, it's one of those comfort episodes, but only because with a DVD player, I can jump forward to the parts I really like.
I think I see your point, but it's one of those that you're either into it or you're not. And you, I just have found it easy to give myself up to the vibe of it. Whereas something like Free for All, the election episode, doesn't require any work on your part. And it's just a brilliant story from start to finish. As a storyteller myself and a writer, I'm fascinated by stories that don't rely that much on dialogue. And I'm always looking for ways to cut dialogue because I tend to yammer too much.
And that's what I love. You're bringing your own creativity and perspective into why the story spoke to you. Number three, have you had the chance to hear any of the audio programs by the British group called Big Finish about The Prisoner that came out in the last couple of years?
No, and it makes me laugh every time you call me number three.
I'm still going to call you number three no matter what you say. You're number three.
No, okay. No, keep doing it. I like it.
So in just a week ahead, number 28 and I are going to give our review, but I'm going to jump people ahead just a tiny bit in this conversation with you and tell you that in the second set of those very fascinating, very densely recorded audio dramas, they actually do, I guess you could say, an expansion or sort of a alternative take on Many Happy Returns. The reason being is that on the television show, you could do half of it with no verbal because you had beautiful things to show people. You can't do an audio drama with no verbal, right? So
no.
What Nicholas and his team did was they really fleshed out the interaction between Six and Mrs. Butterworth and really draw out a much deeper kind of give and take, getting to know each other, understanding how he got there. I will find a way to make sure you can hear that one because I think you'd really like it. It's such a different, it's, you know, the same, you have the same touch points, but it's a deeper connection with that story.
Well, and for most Americans, Mrs. Butterworth means something entirely different.
Totally does. Right? It totally does.
If you can replace that Mrs. Butterworth with a better one, that'd be worth it in and of itself.
It'd be so true. And when 28 and I talked about it in our episode review, he berated me a lot because I just kept going on about how beautiful she was and how statuesque and willowy and probably was a dancer. And he finally said to me, "Do you just want to date Mrs. Butterworth?" And I told him, "Look, if I could find her on Match today in Seattle, I'd be all over it. But it's just, she's not there. They're not that sophisticated."
What's not to like about Mrs. Butterworth?
What's not? She was amazing, even though
honestly,
she turned out to be an evil number two. So that's your comfort one. Now, where you live in the grand metropolis of Los Angeles, as we've chatted before, you run into people all the time who are engaged in the idea of storytelling entertainment. But every so often you meet people, as crazy as it sounds, and they don't know about The Prisoner, correct?
Yes, it's obscene that they don't, but they exist.
Now, if you had, let's say you had just an endless supply of DVDs and Blu-rays walking around in your pack every day, if you were to pick one episode that you think could just draw somebody in, open their mind to what the show is trying to say, to the visuals it's trying to represent, what single episode would you dare give somebody to hope to bring them into the fold?
Well, are you allowing for the first episode to be sort of a gimme that anybody would have to know anyway, or is that part of it? You have to have the first day. You have to have a rival.
Well, but I argue that because of the fact the way the show is produced and the intro itself, the 3-minute intro, I think that, look, you're going to give this to somebody who's smart. Let's be honest. I know you. You're going to talk to somebody who's already smart. I believe they could pick up the concept just from the intro. So I don't think it has to be a rival, but it could if you believe that's the best one.
No, I think you're right about that. But to get the full flavor of just how righteously pissed off Patrick, number six, is, I like that episode, but then again, where we are right now in 2019, Free For All really speaks to me. And I don't know about you, but don't you find that at different ages that you are and at different times, different years that you watch them, don't different episodes speak to you? Maybe that's why Free For All spoke to me so much right now, because we're just through the looking glass. There are times where, you know, The General might have spoken to me when maybe I was in grad school, what's the one that I used to make references to, the one where number six was accused of being unmutual, and to prove.
Yes, that's the one that we just talked about last week. And that is the one that I adamantly believe is the most socially relevant one of all. And that's A Change of Mind. That's when number two says, you will not be tolerated. Your individuality will not be tolerated. And that's what we have in our world today. Any dissenting idea and the horde jumps upon somebody. That's
right. So instead of being unmutual, now we've got cancel culture. And to prove that they won't tolerate him being unmutual, they send a few thugs out to beat him up.
Yeah.
So,
yeah.
The show was so clever. There's a reason why it's every bit as rewarding to watch now as it was when you were born.
Yeah.
And I guess I was just born at the time. But they're just so well made. And I don't, you know, if you are walking down, say, a street in London, I bet you 9 out of 10 people would know The Prisoner. And if you're walking down a street in Seattle or here in Los Angeles, maybe it'd be half that at best. Mm. Americans, I think, don't. Well, I mean, they're so provincial, first of all.
Yeah.
They won't watch anything with subtitles. They won't watch anything that isn't in color. They lose patience with things that has references they don't immediately grasp.
Mm-hmm.
That's a little depressing. I think any human being in 2019 could look at any episode of The Prisoner and think, good Lord, we didn't learn anything, did we? In half a century.
Yeah. I normally number 28 argues with me about how my enthusiasm is unbridled. I think yours is really unbridled, that you think 5 out of 10 people would know the show. I think it's 1 out of 10,000. But I just think that the parable, and that's what people say about the show, the parable of its evergreen nature is what makes it, to me, a catalyst for their conversations. Yes, you use the word canceling, or a while ago people called it doxing, or, you know, just the idea of berating somebody because for some reason that idea of the moment isn't popular. Like, I go back, number three, to this. In the state of Washington, I guess it was 2 years ago, we changed the law, which now makes it legal for people to own or grow or imbibe marijuana. Now, I say this as somebody who's never done anything in my life, but I believe in somebody having freedom. And there's this point where, you know, up until the day that law changed, whether you were an officer in blue or you were an individual, you'd look at somebody who got caught with a joint and go, oh, you're terrible. But then the next day, well, you're fine. That's the scary thing. We do things to change completely our culture and our perspective, and then suddenly the groupthink just instantly goes the other way. That's what Six saw in The Village. I think that's what we see today in the world.
Yes, and I'll have you know that I believe in the law. It's legal down here in California now as well. I just, we're kind of getting off the subject here, but when I was a child, my mom smoked weed and was arrested for it and everything. And I didn't get along with her, but my greatest regret is that she is not alive today to be able to just stroll into a pot shop and buy whatever the hell she wanted.
Right.
But you know, on the subject of conformity and the other stuff that we're talking about, maybe you'll remember the title of the episode, but there's one where number six walks around the village to determine who's a prisoner and who's a warder. And to do so, he just starts barking orders at people.
Yeah, that's checkmate.
I find, okay, right.
Yep, checkmate.
I think that still applies today. That's a frequent reference for me, and it was a very clever plot device by Patrick McGoohan and whoever was responsible for that episode. Let's see, I've got it right here, checkmate. But these are things that, you know, they're evergreen things. They're so beautifully packaged. You got to remember that The Prisoner came on TV right when people were getting color TVs. Yep. And this is why shows like Star Trek were so beautiful. Batman, the Batman 66 show, they had all these beautiful set designs and colors that just popped. The Prisoner is a beautiful looking show that you could show to anybody right now. And I think it really stands up because so much of our TV and movies now are in kind of these washed out colors.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Like it's all sort of like a faded blue or a sepia color. And this is meant to give it some sort of atmosphere that reflects the mood that they're trying to achieve. Man, not The Prisoner. If somebody is holding a TV that's playing The Prisoner and shakes it, you could get a Grand Mall seizure because of the colors.
It is quite a technicolor world. So
yeah, it's beautiful. It's very beautiful and very, very well made. And if you look at other things that were sort of close to the period, like Sapphire and Steel, they're extraordinarily well written and borderline ingenious, but they look terrible. The Prisoner does not look terrible.
Agreed. That's the quality. Now, that same person comes back to you and says, number three, this show is amazing. I want more. And they start to reach for your satchel. They want more of those episodes. What is the one episode you're going to quickly palm and put behind your back because as a Prisoner fan, you really don't want them to see it? Which one's that?
Well, you and anybody else who's listening knows that there's a sort of a core of seven episodes that tell the basic story, right?
Mm-hmm.
And
yep.
some of the others were kind of fillers. Some like Living in Harmony. Some people don't know what to make of it because Patrick McGoohan wanted a Western and that was a way to do it. I still love that one, by the way. And I think it's very entertaining and well done. I don't consider that one to be a throwaway. I think The Girl Who Was Deaf, I mentioned, was sort of a garbage episode before. That's probably the one I don't ever need to see again. And if I'm remembering it correctly, that's the one that's the wraparound device is him telling a story to children.
Correct. Correct.
His adventures as a spy. I just can't stand that episode. How about you?
Yeah, I guess you could say that to a degree. I'm tipping my hand, and I'll actually hold off on a few of my comments for the conversation with number 28. But I'm right there with you. That one wouldn't leave my collection or my archive. No, I wouldn't inflict that on you. No.
I mean, it's a little irritating. It doesn't add anything to me to the story or the number six character or if he was John Drake, whatever the secret agent was, it doesn't really add anything to his adventures. It feels to me like a filler track on an old record album that just was there so they could have something else to broadcast in that time slot.
Yeah. Make those 17 episodes that at least he committed to Lou Grade.
And 17, I mean, that's a lot for a British series. I mean, Fawlty Towers is only, what, a half a dozen episodes for each of its couple seasons?
Yeah.
And I may not be exactly correct about that, but you get the idea.
Yeah.
Whereas American shows are, you know, 22, 24, 26 episodes per season, and it's exhausting. 17 is not a huge amount to fill out. Really?
No.
But, and, I mean, if you could go back in time, would you have told McGoohan, just make the seven you want and we'll call it good. Pretend we've got Netflix and Showtime and HBO now, and you can just do exactly what you as a creator think is needed and not one episode more.
Well, okay. That's a very interesting question. I, from this point today, the first thing I would have said to Patrick was, take a breath, pace yourself. I think the saddest thing was that the gentleman took on so much to do that show in a commitment of time that I think it really affected him and the people around him in a negative way. He made a beautiful thing, but I think that the pressure of it was detrimental. I think which would have made a better idea was to have said, let's literally do 13, then stop. Let those go out. Let the world absorb them. Give yourself, even if you needed, 6 months, 8 months, 9 months. Because the audience, the truth of the matter is, when they saw those episodes, they loved them. The only thing people say in folklore is that they hated Fallout. Okay, so if the audience already, we know from history, loved the first series, then slow down, and maybe we could have got 26 good episodes with, I don't know, 14, 15 brilliant episodes within, just like you said, that album of material. That would be my one dream, is to say, just give yourself some time. Don't run so fast.
I like that. I also, at the same time that I can agree with that, I also think that the imperfections of those 17 episodes make them more endearing, especially when you look at so much of what we consume now that feels like it was composed by committee.
Mm-hmm.
Even a lot of the things I like Avengers Endgame, I loved every minute of that 3-hour movie, but there wasn't one line or one reference or one scene in it that wasn't signed off on by a corporation. And, you know, people may have their problem with Fallout or Once Upon a Time or any of the others in The Prisoner. I think that the imperfections of those really make the things what they are. His, whatever Patrick McGoohan's mental state or exhaustion or whatever it was at the time, you don't get that now because there's so much at stake, so many shareholders, so much money. And for Lord Lou Grade to tell McGoohan, yeah, all right, go ahead. that's amazing. And I like to have that in mind when I go back and watch these. Here's this guy with all these creative people and employees, crew members depending on him, and this is what he did. Holy crap. It's amazing.
On Thursday evening, August 21st, 1969, CBS television affiliates across the U.S. aired The Prisoner episode, Hammer into Anvil. When a young female villager commits suicide after an interrogation by Number 2, Number 6 is determined to avenge her death.
Number 89, Hammer into Anvil.
Mm.
It is primarily a tour de force for Patrick Cargill as Number 2. I think it can be just in terms of just a performance. It's pretty much I think so.
It's his show.
I think so. I think ultimately you're watching him work
or degenerate.
Yeah, but I think it's just, you know, it, from a performance perspective, I would say that's what that is. I don't know. This is one of the classic ones, and this is one in, if you're talking about your sequencing, this is a later one.
Very much so.
You know, many have tried, he actually says at one point. So it is a later one.
Well, it's later for, I think, a couple very important reasons. You've said in previous conversations that at a certain point, Six becomes almost blasé or mundane to the village. And here, he doesn't even care that he's beckoned to Number 2. He ignores him. Yeah. And that's why in this scene, a bunch of them come and hustle him in and take him away, right? We'd never seen that before, right? Yeah. So they force him into doing that. But there's also the fact that the entire plot of the program is not about him escaping. It's not about his resignation. It's not about something mind or, you know, hallucinogen. It's, as you've said over and over and well said, this is about, to me, the most dramatic example of how paranoia affects the person.
Yeah.
Because Six turns the tables
on
that idea of who becomes the mouse and who becomes the cat?
Right.
Who becomes the hammer, and who is the anvil?
Right. Yeah. It starts out with something fairly ridiculous. Number six happens to be strolling by the hospital.
Yeah.
But, you know, if you and actually, at the beginning, I find it a little odd. To me, it seems like number six might be implicated in her death.
You think so?
Well, kind of, because he comes storming in.
Yeah.
And who knows what is the last thing that puts her over the edge? It could be this extra element of chaos. Who knows? Now, well, I know that isn't something that we're supposed to think of or consider. No. But it's always like, number six, if you just calm down a little bit, maybe she wouldn't, when this other person runs in, maybe that's enough to make her just finally be done with it.
Let me ask you this, though, because this is something that's always confounded me. Yes, number six, walking through the village near the hospital and hears her screams. That's why he runs in. And from the audience's point of view, the entire scene where he's showing her the photographs of the very scandalous and upsetting her. My question is that woman already under some sort of mental duress or drug that the village has put into her?
Oh, and that it's at all.
All fake. And the net result of her committing suicide had nothing to do with her. She was a dupe to only compel Six to go so far that he becomes the ire of number two. Meaning, was her suicide actually random? And that's what happened. And then suddenly Six says, I will make you suffer. So now you've set up a fight. Or did the village create the construct of her being screaming and yelling as a way to provoke him? What do you think?
What advantage would they have provoking him? To destroy their own number two?
But they didn't know that Six would be so well adept at turning the table or switching that dynamic.
Well, what were they expecting him to do?
Maybe he would become frantic. Maybe he would become violent himself. Maybe he would do something in seeing her and wanting to be that savior, that he would do something to lose his cool. But he didn't.
I think you can think of it in that way. Do I think that's what the screenwriters intended or what the crew creators intended? No.
Okay.
I think the whole thing of her dying was a shallow construct to get him to destroy number two. Right. The whole point of the show is to make number two paranoid.
Well,
and it could have been anything that pissed off number six enough to do it.
And I agree because I also—
A pretty girl killing herself? Yeah. Well, that's probably the best thing the screenwriters come up with.
I also agree that I think what I liked about it was that it showed me again that Six is not the only person in the village who's being abused or held prisoner.
Right.
So take what I said with a grain of salt before. If you also just take it as from the audience, our perspective, it really shows you that Six is part of a mosaic of people that are being held and abused.
I think it's up for grabs what actually was going on with the woman and the, I'm sure the screenwriter just, I think it's pretty cut and dry.
Okay.
But I think you can have fun with it.
Yeah.
Especially what the relationship was with the girl number two and whatever mental or physiological duress they're putting her under. I'm good with that.
One thing I observed, back to a conversation we had about the Six Tracy brother, is that this number two also, to your point that you made way back then, he also answers the phone and says, yes, yes, sir.
Yeah.
So this is a pattern that we do see if the show goes on long enough that telephone is either to a human or to a group of people, and some of them get addressed as a pronoun, some get addressed as just, answers. But I was interested when I saw that because it was like, okay. It wasn't just Darren's idiosyncrasy.
No, it's a number one, and number one's very important. I wish it was never a sir. I wish there was never any any particular pronoun involved.
I do too.
Wish it was a more amorphous call, of course, yes.
And that's why when you said it before a couple of weeks ago when we talked about it, I thought, no, that was just a Darren you, but no, unfortunately, somebody else has done it. What pulled me out of this was this. That's a dumb way of saying it, but what pulled me out of the program was number six is being trailed or being sort of, if you will, tracked by number 14, the big guy in the sort of, I guess, beige jacket.
Yeah.
But then there's a scene when he goes off to start his mental manipulation of number two. And he starts to do these little things around the village, including going off down to the boat. And what really bothered me was that it sort of was like Star Trek when, okay, we're in a new planet. Let's get the most vital people on the ship and take them down.
Yeah.
And so when number two and number 14 followed him out into the night, leaving the Green Dome and tracking him around the village, I thought, wait a minute. Don't you have every camera and microphone in the world? It really was.
Well, that was a little. How far into it was that, though?
About halfway into the story.
Yeah, well.
He was starting to get, very, very paranoid.
Yeah.
But again, it seemed very odd because most other number twos would stay in that seat of power.
Right.
They'd use the technology. But here, they went out to do skulking in the evening of the village together. And I thought, no, you're putting yourself in peril.
Yeah. I don't know. To me, that was just an extension of his obsession. But
Okay.
I don't know if it was just this one wasn't the fingerprints. This one was the oscilloscope, right? Where they're matching the oscilloscope. Was this fingerprints or just oscilloscope?
No,
this is oscilloscope.
This was so. If in the steps to be able to torture number two, number six does a variety of things. He goes in and he plays all the records as if there's a hidden message.
Yeah.
He writes the papers that he puts inside the boat that have nothing on them.
Right.
He has the idea of using the message from Don Quixote in the newspaper.
Right.
All these ways that he thinks are subliminal messages.
The mirror on the beach. Yeah.
Yes, exactly. Driving him to keep thinking. And what I also loved about this was seeing how number two was so, I didn't like it, but how cruel he was to everyone around him. Because again, in real life, we've all been in environments where a boss we've had or someone is losing control and they start to lash out at the people around them. And just like when the technician came in to bring the papers, he has no knowledge of what's been going on. And he says to him real clearly, they're blank. And he goes, what do you mean they're blank? And he goes, well, there's nothing on them. And then back in their lab, you see these two gentlemen who probably every night go home to their little dormitory in the village, right? Mm. They get paid a pittance. And he's thinking, why is this man yelling at me when I've told him I'm using my skills?
Yeah.
Or when the band leader came in, I felt so bad for the band leader because the band leader comes in to report that number six came up and asked for a song.
Right.
Then he walked away. And number two is yelling at him, parading him, and saying, is it odd that he would ask for a song and walk away? Well, no, it's not odd. First of all, because it's an outside band and you could hear it 10, 20, 30 feet away. Second of all, the band leader didn't necessarily look back to see number six because guess what he's looking at? The band.
Right.
But number two, so in his dissolving, is so insensitive to everybody, all the way to the point that he fires your doppelganger, number 28, which was heartbreaking.
It was heartbreaking.
Well, it was really heartbreaking. And the butler.
Yeah.
He fires, he dispatches the butler.
Yeah. No, all those are good. And the roundish guy who was in the lab was very sympathetic. They're all very sympathetic.
Yeah.
He did a wonderful job. All of them did.
Yeah.
And yes, number 28 being fired is very sad.
Well, because
go ahead.
I was going to say, it's just what gets us to the point where we realize when we talked about a week ago, the episode that I don't even know if I properly sold how much I love or value the idea of a change of mind. You made an extremely eloquent point about six walking on the beach and seeing these birds fly away and the idea of they're in a group and he's alone. Okay. That was a pivotal point in the story and the observation you made about the story about the individual versus the group. I think what we see in this episode is every time number two alienates somebody, every time he alienates a technician or a shop owner or a band leader, that's why at the very end of it, he looks like a child cowering in the globe chair because he realizes he has no one left to support him.
Yeah.
And that's where the paranoia that you've said so many times so well, this is where it's an insidious disease because it almost killed him like a cancer.
Yeah, yeah. The when the interrogation of the band leader in particular is another McGoohan thing. It's a very tight two shot.
Oh, yeah.
And it's performed and timed beautifully. Yeah. And it's very claustrophobic because it's such a tight two shot. That's a director's thing.
And the band leader never gets to move his position.
Yeah. And that's I like McGoohan's hand in the director's chair. I like him when he writes and I like him when he directs. The oscilloscope thing, this is just one of these things that irritates me. He's saying it's number six it's number six voice. So he gets the oscilloscope. And when he freezes them, not only are they like the same, it's absurd. They're the exact same picture.
Yeah.
And in Schizoid Man, there's a thing where they do the fingerprints and it's the exact same picture of the fingerprint. Yeah. It isn't the same fingerprint.
Yeah.
It's the exact same picture of the fingerprint. Those things always annoy me.
But that again, we've talked about the cliches of the 60s. That was a cliche. Yeah. Science would answer all of our questions. And this was even before DNA.
Yeah. The other thing I wish they would do is whenever they show a surveillance camera, which they do sometimes and sometimes they don't, I wish it actually looked like a surveillance camera. Because sometimes in this one where he's writing the note on his desk.
Oh, right.
The camera sort of moves in dollies and stuff. It's like, no.
Agreed.
If it's a surveillance camera. You can pan.
Yeah.
And zoom.
Right.
But don't dolly.
Yes.
I wish the one with Nesbitt, I think it was the one with Nesbitt where actually he's going zoom in there and you actually hear it go.
Yeah. In today's world, in television programs today, what I do like is that when they use observational cameras, I'm going to go back to that one I just watched, This Is Not My Life. In that program that's so well done, whenever the overlords are seeing the characters.
It's usually with range finding things and numbers. Yes,
and it's oftentimes a little bit blurred so that it's really like what the camera would look like when the lens is so small. And it makes me appreciate it because I feel like, well, they don't have as clear a view as they think they do.
Yeah.
There was one statement made here where at the point when two is completely dissolving and number 14 just says, why don't we kill him? And he comes back and he says, our masters will know. That I found interesting because you and I have talked before. I have the belief that the village is it's a group of people all underneath number one. There are people that have to help run the show.
Why is he number two then? If there are other ones, why isn't he number, 40 or something? If there are this whole cadre of people.
I'll tell you what, give a good comparison. I've always wondered at the corporation that I work why we have an executive level if we have a board over them. We have a board of directors and then we have a board of executives. Societies build layers. We love to build layers upon layers upon layers. And the truth of the matter is even in the corporation where I work, there's the directors, there's the officers, then there's the board. But the truth of the matter is the board are only put in place by the owners of the company who are other entities. We love as human beings to build layers. So I feel like the village would have multiple layers too.
I suppose. I don't know. That just – it futzes with the allegory for me.
It's not as linear as
you'd like. No, I don't like it.
Okay.
It's also in the village handbook.
Yeah.
There's one thing I didn't like about the village handbook because he talks about the Illuminati and I'm like, no, don't go there.
Oh, you mean Tim's?
Yeah, Tim talks about Illuminati. He's like, don't do that. Do that.
It's not.
Like Grassy Knoll.
Right. It's not a cult. It's a real thing.
Keep your fiction and keep
your conspiracy.
I love your book, Tim. I know. But that was the one thing I didn't like.
We love Tim, too.
Yeah.
The other part, cool of course, guy. I can assure you imagine the K word made me a little upset this time because when 14 and
it was mercifully short.
It was mercifully short to the point again where I was like, you're just killing me. Why are you showing me this? This is so
dumb.
Yeah.
So dumb. But again, you had to give Dad in 1968 something to watch while the kids are going, no, the rest of this is cool, Dad.
Yeah.
And Dad's like, oh, I want you to punch him in the face.
Yeah. That was a terrible looking sandwich that he fed the pigeon. Terrible looking sandwich. And which is good.
Yeah.
Because
yeah.
that's what I want from village food.
Really, very so I want like a, cafeteria.
I want a white bread sandwich that you that has some material between the two pieces of completely
yeah.
white bread.
Yeah.
That's
yeah,
what
yeah,
I want.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. yeah.
I don't want yeah. brands. I don't want
nope.
anything that looks like food. I just want that.
Yeah.
So that was good.
The staples you're given.
Yeah. The bomb squad was ridiculous. They
oh my God.
They get a bucket of sand.
And they're where thank you. Yeah. They're wearing hard hats and not a single other protective garment.
No. Yeah.
The bomb is not going to blow up and come back down and hit you in the head. It's going to hit you front forward.
Right.
I have to imagine even 1968 bomb squads in London with the IRA and all those kind of things.
Oh, they still have bomb squads in London for World War II ordnance that they right. find in vacant lots.
Well, no, but even then, wouldn't they have some sort of chest protector? That just seemed insane.
Yeah,
yeah, yeah, yeah, yeah. That those things throw me out because that seems so unthoughtful in the design and the where everything else is so well thought out.
How about the beam?
Remember to bring beam? Down the bird?
Yeah, the beam. It was set on the lowest possible.
No, I was
so
okay.
So the bird didn't get hurt. I'm glad the, right, bird, I was, I'm glad the bird didn't
the bird
get
hurt. I was okay with that because what I liked was the idea that they had the ability to use sound waves to yeah. affect things.
No, no, it's good. The beam was silly, but at the same time, I'm glad. I'd like to see some technology. You know, it's the village. I don't yeah. want it to be.
Yeah, a pea
okay,
shooter.
Here's one thing I really liked. And please. This is a Magoon thing too, I think.
Yeah.
When number 14 and number 6 have their fight sequence, yeah. they have the incongruous music. They have like quartet music or something while they're
oh.
fighting, which was great.
To be, again, out of sync with the mood.
You yeah,
nice
it was
music,
great.
But it's a fight.
I love that.
Yeah.
That actually, you can actually do the dumb violent fight thing if it's not you know, the bongos and the horn hits and stuff.
Yeah.
That was cool.
Yeah.
But that's Magoon. Because Magoon's weird.
Right.
I know, you know that was Magoon who did that.
Right, he's playing with it. Where
I liked it.
Where this ends, it's not as if number two is a sympathetic character, but I couldn't help but feel a little bit of sympathy for him because he seems so crushed.
Well, yeah.
Now, he's terrible and he's awful, he's mean, he's part of the infrastructure of the village, but...
He's pathetic.
But it becomes there, right, there it harkens me back to way, way, way long ago. We talked about the article in TV Guide and the CBS executive who said, well, the show will never fly because Americans don't want to see a guy who loses every week. Right. Here's an example where Six did anything but lose.
Right.
Six was right. on the level of like a Mission Impossible thing where he's not only manipulated him emotionally and psychologically, but he's literally destroyed the character. He yeah. won at a physical level, and he won at an intellectual level. And he walks away without as much as a smug expression.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the wherewithal of him being this very, very strong character. I don't know if Hammer and Danville – conceptually, I like it more than I enjoy watching the program because the program is a lot of yelling and violence. There's a lot of intimidation and a lot of browbeating.
Yeah.
So for me to watch it, I do find it a little bit fatiguing. I don't like seeing someone unravel.
Yeah.
But I do like being able to have in the litany of 17 stories, one that you can absolutely say number six is the victor.
Internal announcement to the Village Travel Bureau. In the next episode of the Eternal Village cast, we'll be sharing exciting conversations with our European colleagues about amazing events happening this October in Germany and Britain. Please be prepared for a rise in travel permission requests. End of internal announcement.
All villagers are encouraged to share their thoughts and contributions with the Eternal Village Cast. please send your remarks care of info@theeternalvillage.org. Until our next program, be seeing you.